The second case for oral argument this morning is the next case is Milligan versus the South Dakota Department of Revenue and Regulation. For the appellant, South Dakota Department of Revenue is Ms. Diane Best from the Attorney General's office in Pierre. For the appellee, Milligan is Mr. John Brown, an attorney from Pierre. Justice Zinner has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Thomas Trimble, the presiding judge from the Seventh Circuit, to sit in place. Ms. Best, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. The state of South Dakota is welcomes the opportunity to be before the court this morning. The issues that I want to address with the court start with, first of all, some basic consideration of the legal errors concerning the standard of review that the circuit court used in this matter, and then I'll go into the issue of whether there was substantial evidence in the record to support the agency's determination. This is an administrative appeal. The Sixth Circuit Court sat already as an appellate court in this matter. This court's determination on administrative appeals, of course, their standard of review is very clear. It's to be unaided by any presumption that the circuit court was correct. And so normally, the agency could just jump to this court and start arguing whether there's substantial evidence in the record or not because of this unaided standard. But today I'm here to argue to you that about the circuit court's determination on the standard of review. What the circuit court did is to give a recital of the appropriate standard of review that circuit courts are to follow. But it didn't follow that standard of review. It was a recital, but it did not functionally follow that standard of review. The court considered the matter de novo. It disregarded an independent hearing examiner's determination on credibility.
I'm going to stop you there on the credibility issue. I know that you made a big deal of that in the briefs about the credibility, and they didn't give enough deference to the credibility. But actually, credibility wasn't a big issue in this case, was it? I mean, as I look at the facts, there really isn't any question that, there's not a lot of dispute that certain things were missing in this appraisal. So where does I think it sounds good that you argue this, but it really isn't an issue that much in this case. As I can see.
Your Honor, we would submit that there is an issue concerning credibility. First of all, the state called an expert, longtime expert witness in this matter, and the judge did not defer to any evidence presented by that expert witness. And importantly, what the circuit court did is to take the evidence presented by the licensee that was before them and use that licensee's own assertions regarding his own conduct and call him a witness or call him an expert. So he first of all used the licensee's own assertions as...
But most of them were in agreement, were they not? I mean, it only comes down to a couple things where they were really disagreeing one was whether or not he attached the certification. And that I can understand is maybe a credibility issue, but where else was there even a dispute?
Well, the certification issue is absolutely a credibility issue. If an appraiser does not certify his own work, there is a big trust problem. The appraiser came back and testified before the administrative agency that, well, look, I didn't provide it to you. I certified I gave you my whole file. But then at hearing, I've decided I haven't given the agency my whole file. I forgot to give them the certification. And guess what? It's still not presented to the agency. It's not in the record before this court because it's never been presented into evidence. There wasn't any certification, Your Honor. So licensee says, I gave you my own file. Then he turns around and says, well, I didn't quite give you my own file. And then never does come up with the certification. And there were a couple other matters regarding that issue as well. What he did is he minimized these issues, but regarding the intended user provision and the scope of services provision, he says, well, no big deal, they're boilerplate, I could have provided them and didn't. And in one case, he said, I gave the whole file to the department. Then he came to the hearing and said, well, wait a minute, that's boilerplate, I didn't give it to the department. This is the intended user provision, I believe. I didn't give it to the department. No, wait a minute, later in the hearing, I guess I didn't do that after all. So back and forth, this change of story business goes a great deal to credibility of the licensee involved. And the administrative agency, or the hearing examiner, considered that credibility issue, found against the licensee on credibility. The administrative agency adopted the hearing examiner's determination, affording appropriate deference to the hearing examiner. And it was an independent hearing examiner. This is not somebody employed by the Department of Revenue. This is an independent hearing examiner. And that credibility determination just didn't follow up with the case up through the appellate stage at the circuit court. The circuit court also, as I indicated, disregarded substantial evidence in the ruling in the record regarding the state's expert witness, a longtime expert witness that has appeared in appraiser matters before, specifically with regard to the substantial evidence in the record. I just want to go through the facts of what happened here. An individual named Bob Tinker moved a barn, a large barn in that was built in the 1930s. It's on the edge of town here in Pierre, basically on what I call the outskirts of town. It's an area where there are some ranchettes and horses and dog kennels and that sort of thing. Mr. Tinker applied for a residential loan with a residential loan company on the East Coast. The barn was constructed the barn is advertised as a bed and breakfast. It holds a bed and breakfast permit. It's always been used as a bed and breakfast. This has never been a single family dwelling or a plain residential dwelling of any kind. First it was a barn, then it was a bed and breakfast. The sign out front calls it Horse Feathers Lodge. It's a hunting lodge, bed and breakfast type situation. Mr. Tinker applies for a residential loan. He recommends to the lender that they use licensee Milligan to go ahead and do the appraisal. Mr. Tinker called up Milligan and said, you're okay to do the appraisal according to the company.
Did Tinker have a home on the property other than this, what you call a bed and breakfast?
Yes, he does. He has a dwelling that is adjacent to this barn. It is on the same premises.
Does he live in that, or does he live in the B&B?
The address for the Tinkers is at the dwelling. Mr. Tinker testified at hearing that he resides at the barn, or what I'm calling the barn, the bed and breakfast. The issue with respect to him residing at the bed and breakfast, I think, has got a little confusing in the record. What Milligan is basically saying is, well, it has to be a bed and breakfast, has to be a residence, because according to a Department of Health statute, a bed and breakfast is something where the owner resides on the premises. Well, that's the Milligan version, but the Milligan version doesn't tell you the rest of the definition, which is where the person resides contiguous to the residence. So there's no issue about lawful authority as to whether this is a bed and breakfast. He resides contiguous. He may reside at times in the barn as well.
Isn't the real concern here from the circuit court that the sanction was too severe and that maybe the no harm, no foul wasn't considered appropriately by the agency? I mean, I mean, it seems to me that there really isn't a lot of dispute that there were these things in his appraisal that were insufficient and didn't follow the regulations. But as I read the circuit court, what he was saying is that there really wasn't that much harm, and that that is where the agency or the Department of Revenue went awry.
With respect to that issue, I think that is what the circuit court found, that there wasn't harm. Certainly Mr. Tinker testified that he found a loan elsewhere, and so if this were a private matter between two parties, maybe there wouldn't be harm. But this is a license of an appraiser, and the reason appraisers are licensed is because they have, the public trusts them to do a correct appraisal. The state is representing to the public that there are people who are licensed to do a job, and the public trusts the government of the state of South Dakota to ensure that those people do an adequate job. And it, so the harm is to the public, and it's a trust violation. And that's the part that the circuit court missed. With respect to the 90-day suspension, the circuit court indicated that he thought it was disproportionate. And let me explain why it was not disproportionate to the offenses involved. First of all, Milligan repeatedly minimized those offenses, and the court accepted that minimizing the offenses so large as to put in a footnote, oh well, there's an attic on the house, but not include the 1200 square feet, 9.5 feet tall room that was on the third floor of the house. Yeah, there was an attic, but it was basically like this courtroom. It's an enormous attic, but that wasn't calculated in the square footage. That wasn't calculated in the analysis, but oh well, it's sort of a footnote. So the minimizing these matters.
How would that be used to deceive the client, the person ordering the appraisal? In other words, if there's more square footage there than he was claiming.
The whole effort, I would submit, Your Honor, is designed to shoehorn this establishment into a residential loan setting. The loan that was applied for by Mr. Tinker was for a residential loan under Fannie Mae, and it was a residential lender.
Even if that's the case, then why wouldn't all this additional space in the attic be an additional asset that's not even being mentioned in the appraisal?
The fact is that it's more a commercial establishment and should have been appraised as a commercial establishment, and that room is actually used as a conference room. In fact, I believe the building permit on the property actually calls that so-called attic a conference room. And when you look at commercial appraisals, then you look at cash flow, financial ability to run a commercial establishment. And so the lender would have a great deal of concern as to whether the premises are used for commercial purposes, whether they're fully used, whether they can be fully used, whether the entity involved is capable of fully using those. And none of that analysis was done. What is the highest and best use for the property? Oh, we're assuming it's residential. And it's got a sign out front that says it's a lodge. So these are errors. They're clear errors. They're serious errors. They're errors that were, and I think this is important too, they're errors by a person who holds the highest certification for appraisers that the state has.
Was there testimony, though, about the highest and best use being residential?
There was testimony. Mr. Milligan testified that he did not consider it worthwhile to do a highest and best use analysis, but it wasn't necessary. He was going
for residential. But then doesn't that come down to opinion? I mean, every time you try a case, you've got appraisers that are on one side or the other, and the state calls appraisers themselves for
sure
certain cases, and the highest and best use is a matter of opinion. So why is this an error?
Here,
I see that as an error just because another expert has a different opinion on highest and best use, because sometimes that's even a jury question where you have experts that are making that decision,
sure,
or, I mean, giving their opinions.
If there were a highest and best use analysis provided, if there are any field notes, memorandum, discussion of highest and best use at all in the appraisal, it'd be different. That's where we'd be. But there's nothing. It's an attempt to shoehorn into this residential loan. Oh, he shows up at hearing and says, well, we didn't really need to do a highest and best use. I was going to call this residential. That's basically what the testimony amounts to. So there was no highest and best use. And, of course, that is the cornerstone of the appraisal process, is the highest and best use. So it's an important violation. There are a number of violations. There are trust-type violations, including, actually, one factor to consider in that 90-day suspension, I would submit, is his candor to the board who was considering the issue. He made a filing with the board that said, here, you have my complete appraisal. And then he came to hearing months later and said, oh, whoops, you don't have my complete appraisal. I certified it. Well, come on, there's no certification. So these kind of things all go to the severity of the offense, the issue of whether it will reoccur, and the 90 days is appropriate. And as indicated, Mr. Milligan holds the highest certification permitted by the state. Now, he thinks that that's going to show how credible his testimony is. But in fact, what it tells the state, what I submitted, told the hearing examiner, is this, that he's got the highest certification level possible. He did work that missed the cornerstone of appraisals, the highest and best use. He did work that was sloppy. He neglected to include a whole other floor in the bed and breakfast, and he lacked candor before the board. And so I would submit to you, is that what we want to see in South Dakota for our highest certification level, is to have that quality of work? And the clear answer is no, a 90-day suspension is warranted.
Just a minute. Are you claiming that as a residential use, he presented it to be worth in the neighborhood of $400,000, and as a B&B, it would only be worth, because you'd have to cash flow it, it'd only be worth $250,000?
That might be the case. We would not know, because there was not a cash flow analysis. There was not that kind of financial information provided at all in the appraisal.
Well, on what basis do you claim that Milligan was, say, attempting to deceive his client, the lender?
He didn't provide basic information regarding the premises that he was appraising. The lender had no, I mean, it doesn't say it's a lodge or bed and breakfast. The lender would have had no idea it was a lodge or bed and breakfast, except that the lender happened to, because the appraisal was $400,000, which is a high-end residential, did a double check on it and found, basically drove up there and found out it was Horse Feathers Lodge, and then did their own appraisal, and it's the lender that said, "Boy, this is not right," and reported it to the state. And of course, the state did.
They did their own appraisal. I understood they just reviewed the documentation. Was there somebody that actually made another appraisal?
The lender did what they call a field appraisal. They actually went to the premises. Yes, yes.
The lender hired somebody to do that.
Yes, an appraiser out of Aberdeen. and that appraiser is the one that reported it to the board. Now, the state didn't just take that appraiser's determination. The state did its own analysis, that was the desk appraisal that was done by the state. The state, Sherry Brand called wrong, got the permits, bed and breakfast by the city, bed and breakfast by the state, advertised as a bed and breakfast, got this basic information, went ahead and got the appraisal that Mr. Milligan did, put it before an expert and said, does this qualify with the uniform standards? And the expert that testified at hearing said, absolutely not.
I don't know, this isn't in the record, so it's probably not fair to ask this, but you know, what kind of, how often does this happen, that appraisers are, I mean, was that considered at all? Is this comparable to other sanctions that have been imposed? And how many appraisers have been sanctioned in the last year? And is this within the range? Or was there anything like that that was presented to the court or to the department? I assume the department has that information, though. Is that in the record?
It is not in the record. Okay. The only reference in the record to any other proceeding would be a 2003 appraiser certification. May I continue?
Time's up. If you're going to start another thought, you can complete the answer, and that's it.
I would just refer to In re Klein, which is cited in the brief.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Best. Mr. Brown, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. We're dealing here with an individual who is being exposed to the loss of his professional employment for a substantial period of time based on a subjective evaluation of an appraisal and the unbridled discretion of the appraiser review board. This individual has 32 years of appraisal practice in South Dakota, predating the appraiser certification program. He has, since the onset of the appraiser certification program, secured and always maintained the highest level of state certification, that of a state general appraiser.
So he's never been sanctioned before?
He's never been sanctioned before, is my understanding, and this isn't part of the record. It's my understanding that there had been one prior complaint that resulted in no finding against him.
So how could he, with all that experience, how could he submit what she determines to be such a sloppy appraisal?
There clearly were errors with this appraisal. He's admitted that.
Errors he admits to, isn't he?
Errors he admits to, admitted to at hearing, and is admitted to throughout the procedures.
So how could he submit such a sloppy appraisal?
I guess that, I don't know that I can answer how he could, and whether it was that sloppy an appraisal, I guess, I don't know that I would agree with the characterization there. Certainly those errors, and as the circuit court pointed out, some of those errors were minor technical violations. As Mr. Simpson pointed out, the state's expert, those certain things in whether you agree with the credibility findings of the hearing examiner or the court, certainly those things are of a minor nature. The intended user statement, Mr. Milligan agrees that should have been included. It wasn't included. However, the intended user statement typically is one and the same of the client, and in this case, in fact, was one and the same of the client. So no one was misled.
What about to this case that allows a trial court judge who is on a reviewing an agency's findings? What's different about this case that you would allow the circuit court judge to substitute its opinion on credibility?
Because I believe, Your Honor, that the record indicates that the great majority of the findings, the evidence that was presented in a documentary fashion. And I think that the case law is clear that the circuit court, as well as this court, can review documentary evidence, cold record, equally as well as the hearing examiner. Of course, that's not true with respect to the credibility of live witnesses. I understand that. But here you have before you the actual appraisal that was done. So you have the opportunity to look at that.
Was the record here supplemented by live witnesses in front of the circuit court?
Yes, it was. There were live witnesses. The state's witnesses were Mr. Simpson and Ms. Brenn.
In front of the circuit court?
Not in front of the circuit court.
That's
excuse me. I'm sorry. I misinterpreted. No, that was at the administrative hearing level.
All right. So everything that the Judge Gores looked at was in writing.
Yes, I believe that Judge Gores, and I don't believe that there's a transcript of that circuit court hearing in the record. I believe Judge Gores did ask a question of Mr. Melligan at the hearing, but I wouldn't be able to relate what the question was at this point. Competency for purposes of the USPAP, the competency rule indicates that familiarity with the type of the property, the market involved, the geographic area, and the analytical method are the primary components of competency for respect to taking on an assignment. Mr. Melligan was familiar with this particular property, having initially appraised it when the barn was moved onto the property and initially remodeled and financed with, I believe, the same lender as the refinancing was to take place under this circumstance.
What about the fact that he didn't indicate that it was used as a bed and breakfast or a lodge?
Mr. Melligan has consistently maintained that in and of itself would have been misleading to the lender to indicate that that property had some potential value over and above residential use. It's also instructed to point out that the review appraiser, Ms. Swanhorst, that was hired by the lender to conduct the review appraisal, also, although certainly criticizing Mr. Melligan for what he had done, also looked at the property without the benefit of an interior examination of the property and did her evaluation based on a highest and best use of a residential property. So there was no value assigned by her to the commercial aspects of the property itself.
Should he decide what's misleading to the lender, or should he present the facts and let the lender decide what's a basis for their evaluation?
I think that's a judgment call, Your Honor. I think he made that judgment that to present that type of evidence to the lender would have created a misleading impression on the part of the lender. The property itself, if it was going to be marketed, and that's really what the purpose of appraisal is to determine the market value of the property for the benefit of the lender. And if the property was to be marketed, its best market was going to be as residential use. The facility itself is set up entirely as a residence, with the possible exception of a super adequacy, I believe it was referred to, of number of bedrooms. But the property is indistinguishable from a residence, other than perhaps by size and depending upon your architectural preferences, whether the old barn style is what you would appreciate for a residence. But certainly the interior and photographs submitted with the appraisal certainly indicated the nature of the structure of the building as well as the interior of the building.
Did the photographs include the sign that indicated bed and breakfast?
I don't know that. In fact, as the questioning was going on here, I thought of that, but I didn't have immediate access to those photographs to see whether that, in fact, was the case.
So you say it's his call, and he doesn't have to present the facts. He just has to make a good faith judgment as to whether or not they deserve to know this or not?
Well, he certainly has to present facts that he thinks are relevant to the value of the property. I mean, he does make a good faith judgment that the commercial aspects of the property were insignificant with relation to the value. Mr. Tinker's own testimony, the owner of the property, was that that property was used at that point in time, perhaps 20 nights a year as a bed and breakfast. So approximately 95% of the time, its use was as a residence. In fact, he testified that his hired man did reside in the property for a substantial period of time, and he intended for his parents to live in the property. Its use was as a residence. Certainly, he could have disclosed to the lender that there was a bed and breakfast registration with the state and that it had a special use permit. He did not choose to do that because he believed and still believes that that would have been misleading in and of itself. The minor technical violations, and certainly to the extent that he believes that those things were submitted with the appraisal, could have been corrected. The only explanation for that is the fact that that is not where the state focused its argument as to his violation, and that certainly wasn't his focus as to what the paramount troubling issue, as was characterized by Mr. Simpson. That paramount troubling issue was the lack of any discussion as to the commercial influence of the property.
That was the main concern?
That appears to be the main concern of the state and the department.
He hadn't attached his certification, wasn't that big of an issue at the trial court level?
Certification and the scope of work are essentially, really are boilerplate-like like issues, and it be considering the fact that Mr. Milligan does 300 of these in a typical year, I find it very unlikely that he doesn't include a certification and a scope of work. They're more like the disclaimer that we all put on the ends of our emails that we're not providing legal advice or that this is improperly directed. It's just something that's there, so it's not something that he would have necessarily focused on. I think also especially want to point out that that with respect to the errors that were found in the or that the state found or the hearing examiner found, a couple of those clearly are wrong. And says there's no discussion of it being an old barn. And, well, how much discussion does there need to be? He was criticized for putting it in the footnotes. That's where you put in an appraisal the discussion of unusual aspects of the property. It was discussed in the footnotes that it was an old barn, remodeled, all new plumbing, exterior, interior, the frame old barn. Again, the discussion of the third floor or attic. Also, I noted in looking at the Director of Equalization's notes he called it a two-story structure as well. But clearly there's a discussion of the attic, third floor attic that was unfinished. Certainly it would be suitable for any number of purposes at the point in time that is there. It'd be pure speculation to say that it was going to be a conference room or anything else. That wasn't noted at the time.
So you would say those the trial court was correct in finding those were clearly erroneous findings of fact?
Yes.
And now, if that were the case, and we agree with you and agree with the trial court, is that still rise to the level of reversal?
I think that certainly here, where the record, again, is based on documentary evidence, and whether, in fact, the entire appraisal was misleading, those certainly contribute to that finding that that this whole amalgam of violations that are listed here really almost appear to be more justification for the action they're taking than a real review of the record to determine whether those violations in fact existed.
What other things were they clearly erroneous on?
primarily those two as being clearly erroneous. The highest and best use, that was certainly a major focus. And although there was no detailed discussion of highest and best use, Mr. Mulligan did in fact indicate that its highest and best use was as a residential property. Again, the review appraiser also listed its highest and best use as a residential property in her review.
The state says, however, though, that his failure to explain why he selected it was the problem, and that it would have been all right had he explained why he decided to say that that was the residential was the highest and best use.
I think that comes down to how much is enough. As you pointed out, you have experts that have differing opinions and a matter of explanation. Certainly more explanation would have been helpful in this or any other situation. Where then is that bright line? Where do you decide that's enough explanation or that's not enough explanation? I think that having made that determination, that was adequate.
The department, though, has certain responsibilities. If they have a complaint such as this, and there are that many errors, they can't just say, "Well, we're not going to do anything about it, are we?" I mean, aren't we sending the wrong message if we reverse it and say the department is wrong in sanctioning somebody who makes this many errors and, as they interpret it, a sloppy appraisal?
I think if their decision is characterized by the degree of arbitrary and capricious nature of the decision, that in fact can be done, that the department also has to recognize that they have to be realistic in what they're doing. And I did want to address that before we left, is the level of penalty that's involved here. A 90-day suspension for something that there was no harm, no reliance. Mr. Tinker had in fact canceled the transaction prior to the review appraisal ever having taken place. Although I note that the state characterizes it in their brief as something else, but there's no evidence to the contrary of that. That's Mr. Tinker's testimony, and Ms. Swanhorst agrees that she was not allowed to enter the property at the time because Mr. Tinker told her that there was no loan going forward.
What authority does the circuit court have to amend or change the sanction? Wouldn't it be appropriate for the court, if it finds errors in the department's decision, to remand it for another sanction?
Under 126.36, the Administrative Procedures Act, the court may affirm or remand, reverse or modify if substantial rights are prejudiced because the evidence clearly erroneous in light of the entire evidence in the record, or it's arbitrary or capricious or characterized by an abuse of discretion or clearly unwarranted exercise of discretion. I think the statutory authority is clear.
You think that includes the right to modify sanctions?
Yes, it does.
Under their system for appraisers, if the suspension stands, does he have to make an affirmative showing of competence to get it back after the 90 days, or is the reinstatement automatic?
I believe that I don't know if the reinstatement is automatic as such, but I mean, there may have to be some written application. Frankly, I don't know that, but there's no recertification at that point that I'm aware of.
All right.
Does this have anything to do with the amount of interest charged by the bank, whether this is residential or commercial in nature?
It was being, a loan was requested from a residential, as I understand it, America's Moneyline didn't make commercial loans, so it would be irrelevant whether there was an interest rate differential there.
But they were already the mortgage holder?
Yes.
All right.
Again, I think that we have competing experts, as has been pointed out. Certainly Mr. Mulligan, through his years of experience and level of certification, training, and his activities in appraisals is certainly qualified to express his opinion with respect to this type of appraisal. Again, an expert opinion with respect to the state's expert is no better than the facts upon which it is based. It appears from the opinion that Mr. Simpson created, again, he didn't, he indicated violations that were clearly not violations when you look at the evidence in the appraisal itself. Again, whether his testimony should be given the deference it was given by the hearing examiner, I believe is simply wrong.
What was the amount of the loan it's being applied for?
I don't know the exact amount of the loan necessarily. The loan was being applied for to refinance, but he was going to build a garage or an additional outbuilding, which was the primary purpose.
So was he refinancing at a lower interest rate, the whole thing, or was he just borrowing money to put up a six-stall garage?
I don't know that answer.
All right.
Mine?
No.
Excuse me.
You don't know how much money he was applying for?
No, I don't. I know that the appraisal was with the building to be built came in at $400,000. Without that additional building, there was an $18,000 reduction, which, by the way, was requested by the lender. Came back, the initial appraisal had come in with the building to be built. The lender came back and requested that, said they couldn't make a loan on an as-built basis, and requested that he...
Or a to-be-built.
To-be-built, yes. And that he redo the appraisal, which he did, resulting in an $18,000 reduction in the appraisal amount.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm a little bit surprised that this case has come this far, and we don't even know how much money he was applying for. In response to Judge Trimble's question?
Your Honor, I do not. We weren't able to present evidence at the hearing as to valuation, which although the Klein case seems to say that that's not relevant to the determination of a violation, I can't see how you can separate the value from anything, but we did not get into that.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Thank you.
Ms. Best, you have 10 minutes.
I will do my best to be as brief as I can. First off, there's this issue of certification being boilerplate. It's as boilerplate as an attorney's signature on a summons and complaint. That's boilerplate typing, but it's sure important. The item of choosing not to disclose whether it's a bed and breakfast, that's not a choice. That's proper appraiser requirement. When you seek when a residential loan is sought and it's a residential appraisal, the Fannie Mae guidelines, Exhibit 3 in this case, provide that residential mixed use, if there's any kind of additional use in addition to the residential. So even if you're appraising it as residential, even if the highest and best use is residential, you still have to disclose a mixed use. Is there a beauty shop in the basement? How does that factor into this analysis? That mixed use situation was never disclosed, and that is required under the Fannie Mae guidelines. That is section 306, and it's contained in Exhibit 3 in this case.
If there's an incidental commercial use, would it have eliminated this lender as a possible lender on the property?
It would go into the analysis of whether the mixed use was such that it ultimately made it into a commercial enterprise, and if it was ultimately a commercial enterprise.
Well, I'd say it's only 20%.
I don't know the percentage. Fannie Mae does allow for mixed use, provided that the property is is residential in character, and the mixed use is a minor use, but I don't know the percent on that. There was a question regarding the property and the photographs. That would be Exhibit 1, which is the large white binder, Tab V, and I do have that photograph, if you'd allow me to approach.
Assume you're going to draw our attention to the sign.
The lodge sign. You go to the end of the driveway, the lodge is on your right-hand side, and the regular residential dwelling is on your left-hand side. The regular residential dwelling is just outside that photograph.
I assume this is a photograph then taken by Simpson or Swanhorse rather than Milligan?
I believe that it was.
This picture was not part of the testimony at the hearing before the ALJ?
That photograph was submitted as part of the agency's binder of documents that, right. As exhibits, yes.
All right. Number 6, listing of an inaccurate address for comparable 3. Is that a valid exception that you've taken here? There was testimony that the address given was correct at the time, but had changed later?
Yeah, there were a couple of things with comparable 3. First off, comparable 3 should have, when you do a residential appraisal.
I'm only concerned about number 6.
Okay.
That's listed as there.
Right. Well, comparable 3 should have never been there because it was new construction. It was not a sale, and comparables are only for market conditions, and they would only be for sales. So it's not even within the picture at all. But even if it were a sale, then it's got the wrong address, and the uniform standards provide that you don't have the wrong address, obviously, on these comparables, and the idea being you can't put the wrong address and act like it's right in the middle of the town or something like that.
I guess what I read in there was that the address was correct at the time it was given. The appraisal was made, but it changed at a later time.
Actually, I believe the testimony was that as that house was being constructed, there was a best estimate or a correct address at the time that house was constructed, and Mr. Milligan knew about that, and he had old records that showed that it had that other address on it, and he never brought his records back up to date when he did this appraisal, and by the time he did this appraisal, the address issue had been cleared up, and he should have had the right address. So I think that's just an example of the sloppy work side of it rather than the trust violations or just completely ignoring. But on those comparables, that number 3 was
the appraisal really says that there's 3,400 and some square feet in that house.
Mm-hmm.
Are you sure the attic could be as big as this room?
The county, I think, has it listed at 1,000 square feet. And I think there was other testimony at hearing that listed it at 1,200 or 1,260 square feet.
Are you talking about the attic or the entire structure?
The attic.
All right.
The attic.
So it would be 1,200 to 1,000. Okay.
Yeah, somewhere 1,000, 1,200, somewhere in there. I don't know exactly the size of this room, but that attic has 9.5 feet, has a 9.5 foot ceiling. So this is not your usual.
But that doesn't have anything to do with square feet. You could have an outhouse with a 9.5 foot.
Yeah, I'm just saying. Exactly. But in addition to this, in addition to the square footage, it is 9.5 feet. So it's a sizable, usable conference room.
You don't have to duck with it.
Absolutely not.
All right.
And finally, I just want to make one other comment to the court, Mr. Brown. Stressed the fact that Mr. Milligan has 32 years' experience. He has the highest level of state certification, understood, and shame on him. He should have known better. It's unfortunate to reach this stage. I think one of the members of the court brought that up. It is unfortunate to reach this stage. But if the person with that kind of experience gets by with it, everybody will.
I have a question. If we do agree with Judge Gores and find that some of these findings of fact may have been clearly erroneous, What would be the action that, let's say some of them, at least some of them we agree with Judge Gore's, what would we remand, or would we, what is this court's function then, or do we accept Judge Gore's analysis on the sanctions, or what would happen here, would you foresee? Just assume for that purpose, what would be the remedy?
Right. Well, the remedy that we're requesting, of course, is that this board reverse Judge Gore's decision, and I guess it would have to instruct him to affirm the determination of the agency.
What if we find that he was correct in determining that some of the findings of fact were clearly erroneous? Then where do we go?
Even so, if you find that he's correct, even so, his determination then would be to, the proper procedure would be for him to remand to the agency and for the agency to either come up with a different penalty or remand to the agency for some other determination. But the circuit court's job as an appellate court is not in the first instance to change those sanctions.
Isn't the ordinary sequence of events that the property owner would apply to a lender for a loan?
Yes.
And then the lender would hire an appraiser to do an appraisal?
Correct.
Doesn't the application for the loan indicate the amount of money they want on the loan?
It should, yes. And the application for the loan was not included in the record in this manner.
How do you know how egregious the act is, then, if you don't know what's involved?
Well, the issue here...
I mean, and I'm not talking about finding him wrong. I'm talking about taking away 25% of his yearly income by shutting him down for 90 days. How do you know how egregious it is if you don't know what's going on?
The testimony, as I recall, the testimony in this proceeding is that the loan was to refinance the whole building. So it's a matter of whether he applied for $400,000 or if he had a down payment and he only applied for $300,000, something like that.
But
it's for the whole building. But I don't know the exact numbers. No, I don't. The issue is the uniform standards, and they were clearly violated.
What if he only applied for $50,000 in order to build the garage? Doesn't that make almost all of this immaterial?
No, Your Honor, it does not. He still violated the
technical violations that have nothing to do with the money.
Well, the state has never agreed that these are technical violations. They're trust violations. They're major violations. The cornerstone of an appraisal is to determine that highest and best use. It was never done. It's sloppy work. If those are technicalities, then I might agree with you. But they're not technicalities. They're serious violations, and they ought to be treated as such.
I don't understand why the circuit court can't impose a sanction. The council read the statute that says that the circuit court can modify the department's conclusion. Why is it not possible for us to remand it to the circuit court if we find that there's some correct and some incorrect findings and say impose a sanction?
It's my understanding that statute is designed to allow the circuit court the opportunity to issue a ruling that says may I continue?
Yes, please.
The circuit court to issue a ruling that would say the sanctions were wrong, this isn't as severe, or the sanctions were wrong, this is more severe. And
so the word modify doesn't mean to you, does not mean that the court can modify the sanction.
It can certainly modify the decision of the agency as to whether a serious violation occurred. And whether
any change in the sanction that the court would think would be appropriate would have to be a remand.
Absolutely.
Even though the statute says the court has the power to modify it.
It's my understanding it would work the same way as a trial court sentencing before this court.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.